Thank you, Dave. We always try to do something a little bit different, and we're joined now by David McCloskey, a former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor, his third novel, and he has been there and done that. And I want to invite the audience in here at 504-260-1870, the Oakland Heart Jeweler Talk and Text line, as we begin the conversation. If you have any questions or comments about the CIA or tradecraft or what's real or what's not, text them in and I'll pass them along. With that, we welcome in David McCloskey. How are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing well, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
I read a ton of stuff for work, and your book was the first novel I read in a long time, and I had to suspend my disbelief in a second because I was starting to fact check everything, and I'm thinking, wait a minute, there's a novel now, hang on a second. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I got to tell you that. It really was very enjoyable, and I'm looking forward to now reading the first two. Tell me about, how does a CIA analyst become a novelist?
Well, it was certainly a bit of a roundabout path. You know, I was in for a little under 10 years and never had the thought that I would leave and start writing. But most of my time while I was at CIA, I was working on the Middle East and in particular on Syria. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that was the topic for my first book, Damascus Station. And, you know, that period working on Syria really was an emotional one for me in many respects. You know, I had lived there, worked on it, and you just watched this whole country, you know, fall apart in the middle of the civil war. And so for me, as I left the agency, writing was a way to sort of come to terms with that and to process it. And, you know, I did that for a while before I ever thought about publishing anything. It was just kind of a way to sort of understand what I thought about the world. And at some point, I sort of straightened myself out and said, how do I write something that not only I want to write, but that other people want to read? And the books have come out of that process.
What I read, and I presume what you've written in all three of your books, is real, but it's set in it's real tradecraft, it's real processes, et cetera, but it's set in a fictional setting, accurate?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I think the books have now dealt with very, very different kind of geopolitical settings, right? The first one was Syria, the second one was Russia. This most recent one, The Seventh Floor, is kind of present-day Langley and kind of the CIA with a bit of Russia thrown in. So there's different settings, but I think consistently throughout them, I'm really trying to get the CIA right. You know, there's a lot of really wonderfully entertaining spy fiction out there that doesn't even really try to deal realistically with the tradecraft, much less with, you know, kind of the culture, the bureaucracy, the moral ethic of the place, right? I find that stuff endlessly fascinating and really try in every book, as much as I can responsibly, of course, to really bring the readers into that world, to show them how the CIA actually operates, what are the people like that work there, what does an actual intelligence operation look like, soup to nuts, how do they work? You know, I want to bring readers into that inner ring and show them kind of a bit of the secret world that we don't normally see.
Without giving away any secrets, and along those lines, does the CIA have to vet any of your work?
They do. Yeah, they do. I am required to send anything I write about, you know, CIA, tradecraft, anything I worked on while I was inside the agency, I have to send to them, to a group called the Publication Review Board. And they read everything, they determine if there's anything sensitive in there, and then redact it out if it is, you know. And it's very almost amusing sometimes to deal with them because they send everything back. For some reason, you know, I send them a Word document. When it comes back to me, it's all capitalized. It's in, you know, dozens of PDF files. And best of all, it's literally redacted with a black highlighter. So it kind of looks like it's come out of, you know, a time machine from 1965. But they have so far been flexible in working with me, and I've never had to really change a story or change a plot because of any redactions from CIA.
And what I love about the novel I read, I want to read the first two, is that it really does expose, and I always did have this feeling, and I've always been fascinated by this kind of work and the tradecraft involved, the hall of mirrors that you people live in, right? Because I don't know how you determine what's real and what's not. And one thing that stood out to me in the book was detail and attention to detail, and how I guess that helps you with a story if you focus on details of any one thing.
Yeah, you know, it's...
if that makes sense, if I'm presenting it properly.
No, yeah, it feels... Look, I think they're novels, right? They're in spy fiction, so the paramount, the goal, the objective, right, is for the reader to come into this world and to consume the story, ideally, you know, sacrificing sleep and family time to do so, because they're just so pulled into the world. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to set a groundwork or sort of a foundation of, in my opinion, authenticity or realism, obviously to the characters, to the geopolitics, but because it's a spy novel, to the tradecraft and the detail of how CIA actually functions and what operations actually, how they actually are conducted, right? And if I don't get those little details right, you, the reader, at some point, even if you're not part of this world, you're going to sort of sniff it out, and you're going to know that it's not grounded in reality. And at some point, you might say, well, I'll try another world. I'll go read something else. So I think getting those details right down to, like, the level of, okay, how do CIA officers, when they're trying to move around to spot surveillance, how do you do that? What are the processes for that? What are the techniques? What does it feel like to do that? I'm trying to bring to life kind of the biology of it, the smells of it, the taste of it, the sensation. So you, the reader, are sort of drawn into that world as well.
And I think you do a great job. And I don't think I'm giving anything away here. I'm talking about this part, the section where Sam is in at the Gator Farm and he's trying to memorize every detail. And I guess I'm thinking about the tradecraft that's involved there. How do agents keep their story straight? And when I mentioned Hall of Mirrors, how do you know what's real and what's not? Because in this novel especially, you talk about, you know, there's a mole and there have been agents and counteragents. How do you know that who you're running is not running you? I don't know how you know who to trust.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that is some of the fun of these types of books, is that you don't, you know, and really the premise of The Seventh Floor is essentially there is a Russian mole or double agent operating in the upper reaches of Langley on the seventh floor, which is kind of the executive suite where the director works. You know, who is it, right? And the main character, Artemis Proctor, and Sam, who you mentioned, are investigating this kind of short list of suspects. So it's a bit of a whodunit. But of course, to your point, Tommy, like, we don't know. We don't know who to trust.
But all I mean, in the field, I guess. What I'm getting at, David, is in the field, how do you know, and I don't want you to give away any secrets or anything, obviously, but how do you separate what's real from what's not? How do you keep that straight in your mind?
Yeah. Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, and when you're dealing with humans who you've potentially recruited to supply you with secrets, you know, it's sort of stock and trade in the business to say that most of these people have a bit of a screw loose. Mm-hmm. And so there's a constant effort to test and vet, to understand if this person that you've recruited is actually the real deal. Giving the people polygraphs, checking their information against other sources, giving them tests that they might not even understand or tests, but that allow you to monitor them to understand if they're doing what they said they would do. All of these things sort of are put together, you know, to understand if the agent or the asset that we've recruited is actually under our control or influence or producing things that are true and real. And many times, you know, the picture can be very complicated, where in some cases assets provide things that are, you know, legitimate intelligence, and then they turn around a few months later and they're sort of, you know, making things up because they want more money, or, you know, they want, you know, your approval. It's a very tricky business where you're constantly dealing with the gray, not black and white.
Can anybody really keep a secret?
Yes, you know, people can, not everybody, and certainly not all the time, but, you know, most of the agency officers that I work with are, you know, exceptional at compartmentalizing and keeping secrets, or sort of knowing what are the secrets to keep, right, and what can be shared. But yes, they're out there. They're a rare breed, but they're out there.
When it comes to intelligence gathering, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're talking to David McCloskey, former CIA analyst. His newest book is The Seventh Floor. It's a fun read. We're going to talk about gathering intel and the ways officers do that, open source intelligence, human intelligence. We spoke at one point to James Olson, a former chief of counterintelligence, and he mentioned at one point he and his family had to leave because they were compromised, and I don't know how you can have a real life and a CIA life as well, but you all managed to do it. If y'all have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I'll pass them along when we come back on WWL. We're talking to David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor. That's his newest book. His first two are, I have in front of me here, Damascus Station and Moscow X. He is a former CIA analyst, former consultant at McKinsey & Company, and we love picking his brain. The book is very enjoyable, and David, it was so fun to read something that's not a policy paper or a news story or something else. I got to tell you, how do people get the books?
You can get them pretty much anywhere books are sold. You can get them at Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it at IndieBound. And it's in audio book, ebook, hardcover. So pretty much any format, any place you get your books, you can find it there.
And the name of this one is The Seventh Floor. Somebody texted in and said, in your opinion, David, what film or TV series comes closest to the reality of CIA agents and actions?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is a tough question because there isn't any one that I think does it exceptionally well. One I will say that gets it pretty close is actually a French series called Le Bureau, mm-hmm. which does a great job with the sort of office politics of an intelligence agency, the bureaucracy, the relationship between headquarters and the field, which is always a point of tension. So Le Bureau does a great job. Some American, listeners will probably remember the show The Americans mm-hmm. from about a decade ago about Russian illegals operating in the States. I thought that show did a great job with the street tradecraft, disguises, things like that, that actually are a part of the intelligence business. Another one that I think does a great job with sort of the psychology of working under deep cover is the Netflix show called The Spy, mm-hmm. which is about an Israeli officer under non-official cover in Syria back in the 60s. That show does a fantastic job showing just how difficult it is for somebody to sort of stay undercover for a very long period of time in a very hostile place. Those would be three that I would offer up as good examples of, you know, sort of the mentality and the tradecraft and the operations of the spy business.
So how do you manage to have a real life and an agency life? Because, you know, I guess the people that are killed in action with the CIA have just a star in the wall, right? And we never do find out their names accurate.
Some of them over time have become sort of public.
I guess what I'm saying is there are a lot of heroes that make a big difference in the security of this nation that we never know about. That's accurate?
Yeah, That's absolutely true.
So along those lines, tell me about the sacrifices of the people, and how can you have a real life in addition to an agency life? I don't know how you could do that.
Well, I think it really is hard, and in particular, if you are a case officer who is out there in the field actually trying to recruit spies and run spies, that is it's exceptionally challenging to actually have a normal existence and do that at the same time. And frankly, it's the reason why, it's a very hard job. It's very hard on families. The divorce rate in particular for case officers is sky high. It's exceptionally hard. And, you know, it's sort of doubly hard in many respects because there really isn't public acknowledgement for what you're doing. You know, it really is a shadow business. And so the people who are doing that every day, these kind of secret servants, you know, they do a tremendous amount for the safety and security of our country and really don't get many plaudits for it at all. But it's very hard. It's very challenging to maintain, I think, a kind of normal existence when, you know, everything you're showing to the outside world is actually sort of a deception, right, to hide the reality that you're working for CIA.
It's not an overstatement to say that the work of the CIA has prevented wars and attacks, right?
No, absolutely not an overstatement. That's absolutely true.
Tell me about how does one become a CIA agent? I know you mentioned the farm, right? That's where they train CIA agents?
The farm is where they would do the training for case officers, absolutely. You get into CIA through a number of different routes, some of which are very normal. You know, I mean, I was recruited out of my college as a 19 and 20-year-old to actually join the CIA as an intern, if you can believe it. I took my first polygraph when I was 19. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people come in through school. It's kind of a typical route. Others would come in, you know, later in life after they have some work experience, or in particular, if they have a technical skill, you know, particularly with, you know, coding, let's say, or if they've, you know, written their PhD thesis on, you know, Vladimir Putin, right? I mean, these are the kind of specialists that we're looking for. So there's no really one route in, but it is very sort of dependent on the type of job that they're recruiting you for. I mean, the CIA is a very big place. There's all kinds of people there, from the folks who are actually out there recruiting spies all the way in to people who are doing a lot of the tech stuff. So it's a big place that's recruiting all over, and oftentimes quite openly, to try to find the talent that we need to run, you know, a spy agency in the 21st century.
If you had to pick a quality that a case officer had, I guess I'm using a phrase right, somebody out in the field, that's right, case officer?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Quality, would it be nerves of steel? Would it be an excellent memory? What would you say? Or maybe a couple of them, qualities.
Yeah, I think you've hit two spot on. You know, you need to be able to approach risk with courage and boldness, and you need to be able to, I mean, you know, you'll see in the novels, I try to render this effectively, the ability to catalog a massive amount of information in your mind and hold it there, you know, really matters a lot. The other thing I would add to that list is there is a trade-off or sort of a balance between needing people who are, you know, kind of adrenaline junkies to a degree. I mean, that helps, but you also need to be able to balance that with the ability to appropriately assess risk. And so you need people who are not going to, you know, skydive without the parachute, let's say, right? And you kind of also need people who are good with people, who get how people work and are able to assess them quickly to understand how you might, or if it's even possible, to move someone to sharing a secret with us that they shouldn't. Those are all very unique skills, and I think they tend to be what the agency looks for when you're thinking about the people who you want, you know, recruiting spies.
A lot of tensions in the Middle East right now. How much of the Israeli response, how much is the United States response, prevention, preparation based on intelligence that's being gained on the ground?
Well, I mean, I think on the Israeli side of things, you know, just if we took the pager attack, we took the, you know, decapitation of Hezbollah's leadership over the past month, that has all been enabled by intelligence gathering probably over years in Syria, in Iran, in Lebanon, to map that network to understand who's who, who reports to who lives where, how do they get there, where do they have meetings. I mean, very specific details would have been required for, you know, for Mossad and the IDF to be able to to conduct these attacks so precisely. That is all enabled by an intelligence picture. It's all enabled by massive investments in time and resources that probably go back well over a decade. So, and that's all unseen. You know, we just see the strikes. We just see the pagers blowing up, but we don't really see all the legwork that went into it. And I think it's the same. I mean, you know, it's really the same on the air defense picture, let's say, to take down, you know, these drones and missiles that are arriving in Israel. I mean, a massive investment of technology, of intelligence resources over a long period of time to be able to create that kind of defense and deterrence. I mean, and this is, you know, it's wild because the public just, you don't see this stuff until something pops above the surface or something blows up. But there's a tremendous amount of detailed legwork that goes into each and every one of these operations, and that sort of undergirds, right, this whole sort of shadow war that has burst into the open in the Middle East over the past year.
I enjoyed your book thoroughly. I could talk to you for 25 hours about this straight. David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, author of The Seventh Floor. You can find it at any bookstore. And, man, I'm going to tell you, it was a very enjoyable read. Thank you for writing it. And I'll check out the first two, Damascus Station and Moscow X. A pleasure to talk to you. Thank you, David.
Likewise, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. David McCloskey, former CIA analyst, and the book is called The Seventh Floor. We'll take a break, talk to Jeff Nowak when we come back. WWL Saints sideline reporter, 9:36, 24 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. I 9:42, 18 till 10. Jeff Nowak joins us now, WWL Saints sideline reporter. How you doing, Jeff?
Doing good, Tommy. How are you?
Man, that blue injury tent had more people going in at Sunday than Walmart.
Yeah, that's not fun. That's the NFL for you.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Let's talk about, before we get to the injury situation, all of that, the news all over the place, of course, is Devontae Adams. I don't know. Tell me the story. For people that don't know, I know the story, but for people that don't, explain who he is and what the connection is and where we stand with all of this.
Yeah, so Devontae Adams, receiver for the Raiders, obviously spent forever with Aaron Rodgers in Green Bay. He's dealing with a hamstring injury right now. Whatever that has to do with anything is kind of neither here nor there, but he told the Raiders he would like to be traded. So that's where they are. And the Saints happen to be in a position where they're, you know, he went to Fresno State with Derek Carr, so they have a connection there. Obviously, when he was traded to the Raiders, part of that reason was Derek Carr was there, so they have a very strong connection. The Saints also have Keith Williams as their wide receivers coach, who, when you know it, recruited Devontae Adams to Fresno State, has been like a father figure to him. They've worked together in the off seasons. So you, when a guy has to be traded and you have all that going for you, the Saints obviously become a destination where, like, okay, can they pull off a trade? Now, the issue is Devontae Adams, a 31-year-old wide receiver. He's on a massive contract. The Saints obviously, you know, kind of notoriously never have any cap space to work with beyond, hey, we're going to make this work with restructures and we're going to do this and that. They can get it done. So the question becomes, hey, is it something that you should do? Is it something that you want to do? And anytime a star receiver comes available, you have to kick the tires on it. You know, they'd probably have to give up a premium draft asset, either a second or a third round pick, probably a player on top of that, and then leverage their salary cap in a season that they went into with some pretty moderate, you know, idea that they were going to try to reset and work back to the middle, as Mickey Loomis would say. You've made some pretty conservative signings. You didn't go out this offseason and sign people to these crazy deals. You signed mostly one-year contracts, a lot of stuff that's not committed down the road. So it would be a pretty strong departure from that idea if you suddenly said, hey, at 2-2, we're ready to go all in again. So that's kind of where we are. I feel like, and I think the common idea is, hey, he's going to end up back with Aaron Rodgers, he's going to get traded to the Jets, a team that has plenty of cap space to work with. They have draft assets that they could send and probably do feel like, not unlike where the Saints were with Drew Brees at the end of his career, that, okay, we have a title window with this quarterback. We want to give him every opportunity to succeed. So I think that's where you are. If I'm the Saints and I make this deal, I want to do it on my terms. I'm not getting into a bidding war. Mm-hmm. So I would wait it out, and maybe if there's no deal develops, his market goes down and you can get him in more on a at a price point that makes sense. The Raiders pick up some of that salary, you could get it done. But otherwise, I think it's kind of a lot of noise that won't amount to anything from the Saints' end. I'd be very, very surprised if they made a trade. But that's kind of where you are.
You know, you talk about his hamstring. It does really matter if he can play or not, right? I mean, do you know if he's healthy?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything that you're worried about long-term. It's just kind of a maintenance thing. I mean, we saw Chris Olave deal with a hamstring injury this week and play through it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that it's something that you would be like, well, he's not going to be healthy enough to play, because if you made that trade, it would take you're not making a trade for a guy midweek and then saying, yeah, he's going to be ready to play on Sunday. He's going to know our system. He's going to know everything. So there would be a ramp-up process anyway, and it would probably take 1 to 2 weeks before you felt like he was ready to really contribute in any meaningful way. So I don't think that's going to be the issue if there was a trade on the table that the Saints wanted to make.
And since we're talking about it, what kind of a difference do you think he could make?
I mean, he would become a kind of a security blanket for Derek Carr, a guy, like the Saints. I mean, the Raiders offense in 2022 didn't exactly blow anyone away. Derek ended up getting benched for the final two games of that season. So it wasn't exactly a match made in heaven, but they still combined for 1,290 yards and 12 touchdowns. Davante Adams had an all-pro season with Derek Carr, so they clearly feel comfortable together. I kind of look at, if you go back and watch that fourth down play where Derek kind of threw up the ball to Rashid in the end zone, he wasn't able to come down with it. I think that's what you would be gaining more so than anything else. He's a guy that could operate out of the slot, but he's also a guy that I feel like will be able to go up and make contested catches, right, to be able to battle for a ball. He's a big physical receiver, and that's what I don't think the Saints necessarily have right now. They have two really good receivers in Chris Olave and Rashid Shaheed, guys that can get open, they can beat you downfield, they can win in a lot of different ways, but in those instances where it's like, hey, I have man-to-man, one-on-one coverage on the outside, they're going to send a zero blitz at me, I have to throw the ball early and trust my receiver to go get it. I don't know if you have that. And I kind of go back to week one in 2022, Dennis Allen's first game. What did you do to score that final touchdown? Jameis threw the ball up to Mike Thomas in one-on-one coverage, and he just mossed the guy. He went up over him, and he caught it. Mm-hmm. That's the element that I don't think the Saints offense has right now. So if I'm adding Devontae, it's that. It's that kind of contested catchability that I'm not just getting, I'm getting in a premium way with a receiver that has kind of been on autopilot for 1,000 yards. He has four consecutive 1,000-yard seasons. It would be six if he had three more yards. I think he had 997 yards 1 year. And if that was 1,000 yards, you would be, if you round up, that's six consecutive 1,000-yard seasons. So you're just getting a proven commodity, and I don't think any NFL team would get better by adding him. It's just a question of at what cost.
Let's talk about the Saints injury situation heading into Kansas City. Do we know what we know, or do we not know what we don't know?
Well, so, this is normally by Thursday morning, we would have a picture of the Saints injury status. This week, since they're playing on Monday, the initial injury report doesn't come out until this afternoon. Dennis Allen wouldn't give us any hints or clues or really any information at all into the injury status for certain guys. I think that's something that he's decided is going to be a way he gains an advantage this year, is keeping the other team guessing as late in the week as possible. And I can't begrudge a head coach that. Find a way to whatever you think helps, go for it. But there's certainly a lot of questions. How did Chris Olave come out of that game? How is that hamstring feeling? A lot of times you'll be able to play through something in the moment, and then it kind of creeps up on you. So you have to watch that. Same thing with Alvin Kamara. He was dealing with a rib issue. How did he come out of that game? Taysom Hill obviously left that game with a rib issue. Already had a lung injury, a chest injury, whatever you want to call it, earlier in the season. So how did he come out of that game? A.T. Perry missed that game with a hamstring injury. That's an issue. Willie Gay left with a hand injury. That's an issue. So there's a lot of players that we're going to have to watch and see their status going into next week. Cesar Ruiz is another big one. He missed the game with a knee injury. DeMario Davis is a big one. He missed a game with a hamstring injury. Tyrann Mathieu left with a groin injury. He was already nursing a heel injury, and he kind of said that the groin injury is a product of, hey, you're kind of accommodating one injury and you put more on other parts of your body to, compensate, and then you get injured elsewhere. So, yeah, there's a lot of questions. The big mystery that we don't know for sure yet, we'll get an answer to this afternoon when they get out there to practice. Kendre Miller has been on IR for the first month of the season. He's eligible to return to practice this week. Once you bring a player back, you kind of start the clock on the 21-day window to either add them back to your active roster, or if you do not add them within that window, then they would be done for the season. So I would expect him to be out there. DA was coy about it. But, you know, you look at a guy who's missed 2.5 months, essentially, with a hamstring injury. You have to imagine if he's not ready by now, he's not going to be ready. So we'll see how that goes. If he can get out there, I think it would be a long shot to expect him to be ready to play on Monday. But, you know, the earlier you can get him back out to practice, the earlier you can expect him to be a contributor. Because I think the Saints, one thing they really do need is another punch at the running back position. To this point, it's basically been Alvin Kamara and Taysom Hill and nothing else. And both those guys are now dealing with rib injuries. And I think that's a product of, hey, you're giving them a heavy workload. They're getting taken hit after hit after hit. If you want those guys available to you later in the season, you're going to have to find a way to take some of that workload off them now. And I think Kendre Miller is the guy you look at as saying, hey, maybe he can be that guy.
I can only imagine the night Alvin Kamara had after playing with, was it a broken rib?
Hey, there's been some reports that it's a broken rib, cracked rib. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. It's definitely a significant rib injury that he's playing through, and you know you'll get the good stuff to kind of numb it up and play through it. But yeah, and I think that's just a situation where hey, you may have taken some hits throughout the game that you weren't even aware of in the moment, and then the next day you wake up and you're like, well, that hurts. So yeah, it's always going to be a question of, A, can you continue to play through an injury, and how much can you do throughout the week? And we'll start to get a picture of that today.
And when you say that hurts, you're talking about breathing being that. Let's talk about Shane Lemieux and Lucas Patrick.
Yeah, so you had Shane starting at center. You know, he had his struggle points, obviously. It's his first ever time starting at that position. You know, he had always been told, he said like throughout his career, hey, we think you can play center. Well, he never actually did. Now, he didn't do it at Oregon. He didn't do it with the Giants, I think in large part because he was hurt a lot of his time with the Giants. But I thought he held up pretty well. And now the question becomes, if you get Cesar Ruiz back and you have Landon Young as that backup option, are you better off throwing him at left guard and putting Lucas at center? I'm not sure. And that's going to be something that we kind of figure out throughout this week, is whether that's the best course of action. But I think you got some positive answers in terms of, okay, we can get this done with Lucas at center. And I think, I'm sorry, with Shane at center. And I think Lucas is probably a better left guard than a center. So are you better off keeping him at left guard? I don't know. But one way or the other, there was a scenario where that game kind of really came apart because the offensive line couldn't block. And They did allow a decent amount of pressure. I think Derek handled that pretty well. I think the worst drive, you would say, was the final one before halftime. Kind of got bogged down in midfield. Derek had to throw multiple balls away because he was just, you know, got three guys chasing after him. But generally speaking, I think you saw some positive things with that group to the point that, okay, you can move forward without Eric McCoy. You're definitely not going to have him for at least another three games, probably a little bit longer as he comes back from that groin surgery that he had. So yeah, it's going to, hopefully that group can continue to take steps forward throughout the course of the season.
Need a quick yes or no. You tweeted about the Saints. This would be a Super Bowl or bust thing if they did get Devontae Adams. Would he be the difference between the Saints going to Super Bowl or not? Yes or no?
That's hard to say. I'd say no. I don't think you're one player away, but it doesn't matter what I think. It matters what the front office thinks.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. Back in a flash, we'll find out what Newell Norman's got planned for us today on WWL.